Yes.
You know, 10 years in Mecca and 13 years after migration to Medina.
Yes,
after
right.
Hijrah.
Yes.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Is it feasible?
Mm.
This is my question to you.
Yeah.
I need you to elaborate on this.
Sure, sure.
To, because it's not, you know, that I say so.
Mm.
We're talking about reasoning here, logic.
Yes.
Is it feasible to think that at this particular point of the caravan of Muslims at the time, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, brought them to this point and said, hey, after here, you're on your own. Is it feasible to think?
No.
This is my question.
No, it's not.
I'd like to hear more from you.
Well, the thing
what
is...
What happened?
Well, I mean, we don't need to go far.
You talk about sincerity in intention.
No, we don't need to go far
you
because...
Talk about purity in intention and sincerity.
Yeah, we don't need to go far because the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, even in that 13 years, while he was in Medina, establishing the principles and the foundations of the Tawheed of Islam, he points out two things, two very important things that he keeps emphasizing on. There are so many...
On so many different occasions.
Yeah, occasions.
And in one particular one, in... detail
yeah.
that everything is written
yeah.
about it and
right.
so many different narrations
yeah.
talking
I mean the thing is that at the end of the day we have so many verses in the Quran which refer to this point that he says in a tradition that my family these infallibles these 12 infallibles holy infallibles who will follow after me they are the ship of the Ark of Nuh.
This is only example.
This is
only
an example. You think. But the Quran says, the Holy Quran says, in the after the last khutbah is given in the Hajj, it's given to him as an order that say to them now.
That if you don't do that.
If you don't do this
it's
particular
just like
thing.
You didn't do the whole thing.
You didn't do the whole thing. And I'll save you from the kafirun.
Mm-hmm.
The
I
word
protect
is,
you.
Yeah, I protect
this
you
is
from
what the, you're talking about source. Brother, let me tell you this.
Yeah.
What happened after Prophet? Where did they go wrong?
Exactly.
What went wrong? Because they disconnected themselves from the source because of, look at the mentality.
Yes.
Because they felt like they don't need it.
Yeah, they felt...
The same thing happened with Christianity Jewish faith.
Excuse me, may I make that quote? What does it say in Arabic? They say that the Holy Quran is enough for us?
Hasbuna kitab Allah.
Hasbuna kitab Allah.
Quran is enough for us.
Yeah.
But Quran has to have a teacher. According to the teachings of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. This is the story of very good, important subject and significant at the same time. Purity of intention and sincerity. When you're connected to the source, let's summarize it, then you see yourself with someone who knows what's going on.
Dr. Hasni, thank you very much for that. And as I say, I hope the listeners have enjoyed our discussion about the great holy personality of Imam Khomeini, God bless him. And there are so many dimensions still to be discussed. We've just, as I say, we've just scraped the surface. We haven't even done anything yet. But let's carry on in the next session and talk more about
God
these,
willing, we'll do
yeah,
that.
With the, inshallah, with the more aspects of this great personality. But it's enough for me to say at this moment in time, thank you very much for listening.
You are more than
May the
welcome.
Peace and blessings of Allah and mercy be upon you all. Thank you and goodbye.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
The Light.
Chameleons changing color is one of the most fascinating traits amongst living creatures. Now, can't humans make a robot with the same capability? In a science lab in Seoul, a team of engineers have created a robot that mimics the color-changing ability of the famous lizard. The researchers have made the skin with a special ink that changes color based on temperature and is controlled by tiny flexible heaters. The head engineer says creating a wearable device that can actively change color and patterns was the main goal of the study.
The pattern of South Korea's military uniform is made for woodland and certain colors. So if you wear this military uniform and go to the desert, you can be easily exposed. Actively changing colors and patterns to match different surroundings is the key of camouflage technology, and we made this possible.
The total thickness of the flexible, multi-layered artificial skin is thinner than a human hair. The scientists envision that their research can be adapted for military uniforms to help soldiers blend into their surroundings. It can also be used for aesthetic purposes such as fashion, exterior of cars and buildings, as well as future display technology.
Visitors and staff of a French zoo have been amazed by the surprise birth of two African lion cubs. The babies, a boy and a girl, were born 2 weeks ago in Amnéville Zoo. Their birth was unexpected due to their father's advanced age of 17. The cubs will live under constant surveillance for a couple of months so that their health is reassured. According to zookeepers, they are currently in good health. The Amnéville Zoo has asked people on social media to name the newborns. The German capital, Berlin, turns colorful as the annual mural festival has brought artists together to display their works around the city. Artists have instilled new life into neighborhoods with giant murals that attracted hundreds of visitors. This year's event was resumed under the motto Home Street Home after its 2020 edition was canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Organizers say the paintings invite people to discover the city as a gigantic open-air gallery.
The Italian city of Venice has held its annual historical regatta festival, attracting hundreds of spectators. People wearing costumes rowed their colorful boats and gondolas through the city's Grand Canal. The participants reenacted the city's history by carrying people dressed up as the King of Venice and his wife up the canal. Some of the riders also put their strength to the test by racing each other throughout the day. The regatta dates back to the 13th century and has been held every year in September.
An extraordinary concert has entertained hundreds of people in the German city of Dresden. Musicians performed underwater while five steamboats accompanied them with their whistles. The City Symphony Orchestra organized the event in an attempt to boost up people exhausted by the COVID-19 pandemic. Residents welcomed the program, describing it as a glimmer of hope. They believe that the unusual concert was good for heart and soul.
Young generations are becoming more concerned about our planet and seem determined to contribute to make it environmentally friendly. A great example is this Parisian boy who spends a lot of time fishing metals out of rivers and canals in the French capital. Good for him. 11-year-old Raphael uses magnets and grappling irons to fish metal objects out of the Seine River in Paris. Over the past 2 years, he has taken hundreds of bikes, scooters and shopping trolleys out of the water. The boy says the practice was initially a hobby for him, but it eventually turned into a reasonability and a method to raise awareness about climate and environmental issues.
My goal is to raise awareness so that a maximum of people do something. They don't have to do what I do, but at least do something. Even if it's not necessarily cleaning up cannons, it could just be picking up a cigarette butt.
Raphael has also fished some very rare items out of different canals, including handguns, pieces of jewelry, and an artillery shell. An exhibition is therefore being held in Paris where Raphael's findings are going to be put on display. The young environmentalist has also been awarded the Medal of Paris, a prize belonging to the residents who accomplish a deed concerning the city. Brazilian researchers have discovered a substance that could be used as a drug against COVID-19, and you may not like where they found it. A group of scientists have come across a potentially life-saving molecule in the venom of a kind of Brazilian pit viper. It is a peptide or a chain of amino acids that limited reproduction of the coronavirus in monkey cells by 75%. The peptide can be synthesized in the laboratory, so there is no need to capture more vipers. Now the researchers will evaluate whether the molecule can be used to create medicine for treating people with COVID-19. Thousands of cows have descended from their summer quarters in the Swiss Alps to enjoy the warm temperatures of lower heights. The cattle herds spent 7 weeks in the Alpine mountains, grazing at an altitude of nearly 2,000 meters. Their journey down started before sunrise and took almost 5 hours to complete. The cows, which couldn't make the trek due to injury, had already been carried down using trucks and helicopters. Farming has found an alternative look in the Netherlands, where cows produce milk on an eco-friendly floating farm. That may seem a surreal image of Rotterdam, the largest port in Europe. A herd of cows peacefully feed on board of what is known as the world's first floating farm. They live on the top floor of the three-story farm, while their milk is turned into dairy products on the other two floors. The floating farm opened in 2019. The owners say it aims to show the future of breeding and farming.
You must realize that the world is under pressure. Therefore, we have less and less land, agricultural land. Our idea is that in this way, we can actually create agricultural land close to the city and also adaptable to the climate.
The floating farm is seen as a good alternative for normal farming in the Netherlands. That's a country with scarce land while being threatened by climate change. The farm's owners have also applied eco-friendly methods to make it durable and self-sufficient as much as possible. The methods include using solar panels and feeding the cows with grass from sports fields.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
An Australian cyclist has become the first woman in history to pull off a front flip on a mountain bike. Caroline Birkenen landed the front flip at the Audi 9 cycling event in the German city of Birkenfeld. The maneuver won the former two-time Olympian the women's best trick title in the event. This was the first time the 9s featured a female category. The annual event gathers the world's best slopestyle and freeride mountain cyclists to Germany. A spectacular light show has mesmerized people in a Greek capital, Athens. 200 colorful drones performed a short harmonized display illuminating the night sky. Their colors and shapes were changing alongside music tracks. The show, organized by the Athens Cultural Center, took place 120 meters above the National Opera and Library. an Afghan woman has received the gift of life at a most unlikely time while flying. 26-year-old Saman Nouri was on a plane bound for Birmingham when she started having contractions. She gave birth to a little girl in an altitude of 10,000 meters with the help of the cabin crew. Born in Kuwaiti airspace, the baby is named Hawa, which means Eve or air in Dari. Both mother and daughter are completely healthy. The aircraft was carrying Afghan citizens evacuated from Kabul. The passengers left behind their old lives, but were gifted with a new one in the process. After all, life does find a way. A French graffiti artist has created a monumental mountaintop project to encourage a more contemplative approach to life, aiming at lifting people's spirits. The giant 1,500 square meter painting is called A New Lease of Life. It was painted on the summit of Mollison Peak in the western Swiss Alps. The 32-year-old artist says he was inspired by the likeness of childlike wonder. The mural depicts a little boy blowing bubbles in an area known for its clouds. The artist says he wanted to reflect the link between children and sky gazing.
I think we live in a world that includes anxiety, and we need a little lightness to balance it. So I believe that the clouds mean dreams and imagination. When we were kids, we liked to imagine shapes in the clouds and so on. And I believe that this is a moment where we have to breathe and also imagine the world of tomorrow with a certain lightness through daydreaming.
Saif also says he designs his creations to fit in with the environment using biodegradable paints made from natural pigments. The French artist is known for his massive graffiti works on grass that are best seen from the air. Some of his other works have adorned an impoverished shanty town in South Africa and the lawn in front of the UN headquarters in Geneva. One of Mexico's largest zoos has launched a one-of-a-kind exhibition, with the star of the show being a manatee couple. Visitors will be able to see the couple at the new exhibition, which is part of the largest aquarium in the country. The zoo received the manatee couple from the Caribbean with the intention of raising awareness for the protection of the species. Part of the ticket proceeds will go toward conservation efforts. Manatees are fully aquatic, mostly herbivorous marine mammals that are sometimes known as sea cows. These funny-looking creatures are endangered because of pollution and fishing techniques.
Paleontologists in Egypt have discovered fossilized bones of an ancient whale that could probably walk on land and swim in water. Scientists found the skull, jaw, and some ribs and identified the parts as the 43-million-year-old ancestor of the modern whale. It's also the earliest type of semi-aquatic whale found in Africa. The whale is estimated to have been 10 meters in length, weighing over half a ton, and was likely a top predator. Scientists say the four-legged whale is a key new species that helps trace the transition of whales from land to sea. Paleontologists believe that the ancestors of modern whales developed from deer-like mammals living on land over a 10-million-year period. The fossilized remains were discovered in Egypt's western desert, which was once covered by sea. A French beekeeper has invented a unique device to keep his beehives safe after suffering a traumatic loss of 35 of them to hungry Asian hornets. The device is a one-way mechanism that baits hornets with sugary water, and once they get in through a funnel, they never come out. Originally, the trap was made of wooden crates and metal mesh, but now they are 3D printed in plastic. Dennis made his first lobster pot to catch the hornets in 2016 and now makes the traps in bulk due to growing demand. the Asian hornets are an invasive insect that arrived in France via a pottery shipment from China. The killer hornet can eat through an entire hive in a matter of hours. There is a festive occasion for a Mexican zoo amid a rare birth boom in its lion enclosure. Keepers and visitors are amazed to hear roars of three newborn cubs. The three baby lions that are trying very hard to roar were born just 2 weeks ago in Zacango Zoo. The zookeepers separate them from their mother for a few hours a day to feed them because their mother cannot produce milk. The two female and male cubs would live under constant surveillance for a couple of months so that their health is reassured. They are reported to be currently in good health.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Healthy boys may be more likely to be admitted to hospital with a rare side effect of the Pfizer BioNTech COVID vaccine that causes inflammation of the heart than with COVID itself, US researchers have claimed. Their analysis of medical data suggests that boys aged between 12 and 15 with no underlying medical conditions are 4 to 6 times more likely to be diagnosed with vaccine-related myocarditis than ending up in hospital with COVID over a 4-month period. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian science editor Ian Sample. The piece is titled, "Boys More at Risk from Pfizer Jab Side Effect Than COVID, Suggests Study." Healthy boys may be more likely to be admitted to hospital with a rare side effect of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccine that causes inflammation of the heart than with COVID itself, American researchers have claimed. Their analysis of medical data suggests that boys aged between 12 and 15 with no underlying medical conditions are 4 to 6 times more likely to be diagnosed with vaccine-related myocarditis than ending up in hospital with COVID over a 4-month period. Most children who experienced the rare side effect had symptoms within days of the second shot of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, though a similar side effect is seen with the Moderna jab as well. About 86% of the boys affected required some hospital care, the authors said. Saul Faust, professor of pediatric immunology and infectious diseases at the University of Southampton in England, who was not involved in the work, said the findings appear to justify the cautious approach taken on teenage vaccines by the British government's Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunization, JCVI. The Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunization, JCVI, did not recommend vaccinating healthy 12 to 15-year-olds. But referred the matter to the UK's chief medical officers, who are expected to make a final decision next week. Children aged 12 to 15 who are particularly vulnerable to COVID or who live with an at-risk person are eligible for the vaccine shots. In the latest study, which has yet to be peer-reviewed, Dr. Tracy Hoag at the University of California and colleagues analyzed adverse reactions to COVID vaccines in U.S. children aged 12 to 17 during the first 6 months of 2021. They estimate the rate of myocarditis after 2 shots of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine to be 162.2 cases per million for healthy boys aged between 12 and 15, and 94 cases per million for healthy boys aged 16 and 17. The equivalent rates for girls were 13.4 and 13 cases per million, respectively. At current U.S. infection rates, the risk of a healthy adolescent being taken to hospital with COVID in the next 120 days is about 44 per million, they said. How reliable the data is and whether similar numbers could be seen in the United Kingdom if healthy 12 to 15-year-olds are vaccinated are unclear. Vaccine reactions are recorded differently in the United States, and vaccine shots are given at longer time intervals in the United Kingdom. According to the UK medicines regulator, the rate of myocarditis after COVID vaccination is only 6 per million shots of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. So far, British children have not been admitted to hospital for COVID in large numbers and may not be at risk of long COVID. While the recent CLOCK study found that up to 14% of children who caught COVID may still have symptoms 15 weeks later, levels of fatigue appear similar to those in children who have not caught the virus. This suggests that children may be spared some of the most debilitating problems seen in adult long COVID. The overwhelming majority of myocarditis appears after the second dose of the vaccine, so offering single shots of the vaccine could protect children while reducing their risk of the side effect even further. While myocarditis after vaccination is exceptionally rare, we may be able to change the first or second doses or combine vaccines differently to avoid the risk at all, once we understand the physiology better, said Professor Faust. On balance, there is no urgency to immunize children from a medical perspective, although if schools are unable to maintain education for the vast majority at all times, the overall balance could shift. If my two teenage children are offered the vaccine by the NHS, my GP wife and I will have no hesitation in allowing them to receive the vaccine. Professor Adam Finn, a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunization at the University of Bristol, said, "I stand by the Joint Committee on Vaccine and Immunization advice, which is not to go ahead at this time with vaccinating healthy 12 to 15-year-olds on health outcome risk-benefit grounds, given the current uncertainty. As there is a small but plausible risk that rare harms could turn out to outweigh modest benefits."
At midnight, April 1st, 2015, the thunder of warplanes accompanied by massive explosions woke the children of Yemen. Saudi Arabia had initiated a war against Yemen, which, as claimed by the Saudi ambassador to Washington, Adel Al-Jubeir, sought to re-establish the legitimacy of deposed Yemeni president Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi, and also to prevent the Ansarullah movement from dominating the Arab Peninsula country. The sudden invasion, which took place after receiving a green light from the United States and Britain, was the most visible and blatant instance of the Saudi regime's interference in the fate of the Yemeni people over recent years. An overt war waged after al-Saud's ever duplicitous goals and policies had been met with defeat. But what had taken place within Yemen's political environment that had forced foreign powers to undertake all but open military invasion to change the balance of power in Yemen and secure their aims? How had Ansarullah transformed from a small group to such power that Saudi Arabia contravened international law, acting preemptively to preserve the interests of itself as well as those of its Persian Gulf allies? These questions can be answered with reference to a decade of tension in Yemen's political atmosphere, which featured barbaric acts such as the Sixfold Wars, which the incumbent government unleashed upon the Ansarullah, the consequence of which gave Ansarullah greater sophistication and experience by the day. This chronicle dates back some 20 years.
The Heart of Agate, Part 1.
On May 22, 1990, the Republic of Yemen was born out of the union between North and South Yemen, and Ali Abdullah Saleh, the president of the former country, was officially sworn in as the new nation's head of state. However, his discriminatory policies led to discontent among the people and leaders of the South, as well as numerous tensions and crises, eventually causing a civil war in 1994. The war, which is viewed by some as a war of unification and by others as a war of separation, went on for 2 months. During the war, the central government massacred the people of the South and destroyed the area's facilities and infrastructures, enjoying the jurisprudential and spiritual support of Yemen's Muslim Brotherhood, also known as the Reform Movement, and having received the requisite go-aheads and fatwas of the muftis affiliated to the Brotherhood to accuse the Southerners of apostasy. Soon after, on July 7, 1994, Saleh's government conquered Aden, defeating the movement of the South, forcing its leaders to flee.
It was then that the Northerners started establishing dominance over the Southerners. They saw it fit to gain dominance over everything, and Ali Abdullah Saleh managed to fully demolish the South and completely expand his control there.
Saleh embarked on many things. He assumed control of many power centers and spent a lot of money on them.
Of course, these things were not Saleh's doing alone. These were done by the coalition of politicians from his family in Sanhan and Abdullah ibn Hussein al-Ahmaz's family in Hashid.
Saudi Arabia's interference in Yemen continued in a direct manner. For instance, it was Saudi Arabia which always supported Ali Mohsen al-Ahmar, and it was the kingdom which helped him rise to his military authority.
Having wearing their inroads and after attaining control over the situation, they, especially al-Ahmar, were seeking to become the main puppeteers in Yemen.
Wealth was drawn around these people and the hypocrites around them, and the country turned into an area of ransacking and plunder.
And following Saleh's victory, he was faced with the demand to form a national unity government. The formation of such government would appease the losers of the war. The winners, however, rejected the proposal.
One of those severely insisting upon national unity was Sayyid Badruddin al-Houthi, the leader of Zaydi Houthis,
who was a great erudite belonging to the city of Houth, south of the Sa'ada governorate. He is one of the pillars of the Zaydi sect.
Sayyid Badruddin is one of the Zaydi sect's prominent scholars and jurisprudents. He's also the father of Sayyid Hussein al-Houthi, and the current leader of the Houthi movement is Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi.
And they conspired against the brothers, whom they considered to be their opponents and real enemies. Though those brothers were the followers of the House of Muhammad, the Zaydi sect and the noble people from the Fals, and much oppression and torture was brought about.
It had been going on for a while that some of those around Saleh, who had supported him in the war, were throwing tantrums. They were subjects of the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood, and this was an element which was a potential threat to Saleh's government in the long run. From Saleh's perspective, Zaydis were the only people whom he could pit against the Brotherhood, should he see fit.
And since Saleh knew this fact, he resorted to the divide and rule policy, which was being used by Britain at the time. He called the policy dancing on the heads of snakes, through which he would support one side against the other, and in most cases, support both of the sides.
In 1993, the Zaydis, who included a group of scholars, among whom were Sayyid Majduddin Muhammad al-Mu'ayyidi and Sayyid Badruddin al-Houthi, and who mostly resided in the Sa'dar Governorate, created the Al-Haq Islamic Party. It is clear that Saleh's policy at the time was to accommodate developments of this type, and institutions like the Al-Haq Party were able to stand in the face of extremist and radical ideologies in Yemen, including Al-Qaeda. This was a plus for Saleh's government, which was under pressure from the United States to confront Al-Qaeda.
The party, however, roused the opposition on matters of religious emulation by embarking on innovation and being influenced by the revolution of Imam Khomeini. In other words, they mobilized, while those sources of emulation merely espoused jurisprudence, scholarship, and things of that nature.
Therefore, a rift came about between the conservatives and the open-minded. The former comprised the Zaydi scholars and the elder ones, while the latter was led by Mohammed Azan.
But for how long could this go on? There was need for a moderate point of view to converge the two lines of thought and prevent further division and unease. Hussein al-Houthi, a like-minded friend of Azan's, who maintained a moderate position, undertook to do this while engaging in political activity. Sayyid Hussein started to write and propagate his ideology, especially among the young generation.
Hussein al-Houthi was a parliamentarian, a strong personality who maintained innovative thoughts. He had a special charisma which awarded him popularity and fame among Zaydis, especially in Sa'ada.
And Sayyid Badr al-Din al-Houthi maintained a moderate position which caused everyone to find solace in him.
And this made him similar to other notable personalities, great people and religious personages who undertook to promulgate ideology and educate people.
A time had come that oppression in Yemen had come to a head, and the country was experiencing intellectual, economic, and military invasion and war on its own soil.
After returning from Sudan, he tried to resolve the problems which had grown deeper between the open-minded and conservative movements.
He said, "This studying of yours is just for show. While you're thumbing through books, oppression has thrown its clutches over the country."
In his mind, the problem resided in divergence from the noble Quran. Hence, he started to invite people to return to the holy book.
With every policy that would be issued, he would circulate some Quranic verses and compare the meaning to the existing circumstances.
And then the ideology of revolution and change and refusal to accept the present circumstances was engendered in his mind.
Sayyid Hussein al-Houthi resided in Al-Maran, in northern Yemen, on a mountain that overlooked Saudi Arabia. He embarked upon contemplation as well as addressing and preparing the youth, who developed a strong admiration towards Sayyid and were influenced by him.
So, at that time, he created a group in Saada named Al-Shabab Al-Mumen and adopted a number of slogans as well as political and cultural inclinations. The movement is essentially a cultural one. In other words, it maintains a cultural plan of action and perspective for its activities and presence.
The movement rose up, devoted to the seeking of justice, and it rejected all foreign intervention as well as oppression, callousness, and tyranny.
He possessed an authoritative presence in Saada. This was alarming for the central government in Sana'a and Yemen's northern neighbor, Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia was the United States' main ally in the region, a fact that had made the kingdom a source of concern for Yemen's government. Saleh was being gradually pressured to act against the Zaydis. What he did, though, was to begin suppressing the main allies of the Saudis, namely the Salafis, instead of fighting the Zaydis.
And after the events of 9/11, the relations between the US and Saudi Arabia became strained since most of the people who carried out the operation possessed Saudi passports. It was then that Saleh thought he could become the US's premier ally in the region.
Saleh tried to ally himself with the US in a coalition against terrorism.
Therefore, he speedily undertook to eradicate the Salafis, especially those who had returned from Afghanistan.
Then the time came when Saleh finally pit the Houthis against the Salafis. But things did not go according to his long-time plans. Instead of confronting and taking revenge on Wahhabis and Salafis, Hussein al-Houthi turned the confrontation into one against the United States.
He did so by declaring he would not accept that U.S. interrogators come and interrogate Yemeni civilians.
Bush started an international war on Islam. He called it war on terrorism. Sayyid Hussein, however, denounced it as a war on Islam.
And he said the U.S. was doing this on a global scale, so that we may face a moral defeat and that the killing of Muslims would turn into an everyday matter. He said moral defeat was more dangerous than military defeat and therefore started to chant this slogan.
Therefore, Sayyid Hussein said he would alienate the people from the slogan of fear, and if the government became angry, he would ask them, "Why do you lose your temper over the US and Israel?"
Accordingly, he sought to popularize moral slogans so we do not face moral defeat, and these slogans were aimed to counter that of Bush's, who deceptively said, "Anyone who is not with us is against us." Ali Abdullah Saleh came to the conclusion that this undertaking of Sayyid Hussein had robbed him of the opportunity to become the U.S.'s preferred ally in the region.
And he escalated oppression, tyranny, destruction, torture, and imprisonment.
On January 18, 2004, thousands of soldiers, backed by tens of aircraft, hundreds of tanks, cannons, and other heavy and semi-heavy military equipment, attacked the areas of El Nashur, El Saifi, Maran, and Zahyan in the Saadar Governorate. It was the government's first war on the Houthis, which lasted for 3 months.
The person who directed the wars against Zaidi Shias, or Al-Shabaab al-Mumen, was named Ali Mohsen al-Amar and was among those close to President Ali Abdullah Saleh. He, however, was inclined toward Wahhabism. Known to maintain such inclination, he received his orders from Saudi Arabia.
The civil war lasted for some time, and then Sayyid Hussein was martyred and his body was confiscated. The body was placed in one of the central prisons in Sana'a in order to be out of reach of his followers, so that his followers could not erect a tomb for him, and so that Sayyid, who was the leader of a movement, could not be paid tribute to.
However, prior to the fall of Maran, Sayyid Hussein had ordered Sayyid Abdullah Malik al-Houthi to be transferred from the area to another. He secretly knew of Abdul Malik's importance without divulging this to anyone else.
The death of Sayyid Hussein al-Houthi, the leader of the Zaydis, and many of his aides dissipated Saleh's and Ali Mohsen al-Ahmar's concerns regarding the situation in Saadar, especially in light of the fact that the movement had lost its leader.
The Al-Shabaab al-Mumen movement, however, did not go disband, but lived on thanks to the support of Hussein's father and martyr, Al-Amer Badr al-Din al-Houthi.
At the time, negotiations were underway between Ansar and the government. The talks were led by Sayyid Badr al-Din al-Houthi, who represented Ansarullah.
The government, though, did not live to its promises. Sayyid Badr al-Din consequently returned to the area of Al-Nashur.
Following Sayyid Hussein's martyrdom, all eyes turned towards Abdullah al-Ruzami, his former colleague in the House of Representatives, with no one even thinking of Abdul Malik. Abdullah al-Ruzami was residing in Al-Nashur, and thus Ansarullah members made their way to that area, gathering there.
The area of Al-Nashur is very small and surrounded by mountains on every side.
At the time, Sayyid Abdul Malik said it was a mistake for the Ansarullah to congregate in the area as it is too open and also it is close to a major garrison. He said that it was incumbent upon the movement to spread out and ordered each member to start operating independently in the area. Al-Ruzami disapproved of this idea.
Towards the end of January 2005, Abdullah Saleh waged his second war on the Houthis. On this occasion, al-Ruzami was the leader of the Ansarullah movement's military wing and undertook to direct its defense. Despite the efforts and martyrdom of many of his brethren, this war too ended with the movement's defeat and his arrest on March 27, 2005. As their enemy closed in, Badr al-Din al-Houthi retreated through the impassable mountain range of Saadar together with his remaining fighters.
Some of these fighters would actually tie themselves up to force themselves to stand their ground, and there they would fight until they were murdered.
After this second war, leadership was passed down to Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who is now considered the leader of the Ansarullah.
Sayyid Abdul Malik departed for Matran, which is a strategic area geographically reinforced. On his departure, he was accompanied by a small number of people, but with time, others joined him, believing in his cause.
It was during this sojourn that people began to be drawn to Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the younger son of Sayyid Badr al-Din, despite there being an older brother named Yahya. Abdul Malik, born in 1979 in Saadar Governorate, rose to a leadership rank of Shabab al-Mu'min, owing to his personal characteristic.
Once his popularity was apparent, Abdul Malik started to preach some ideological themes to initiate people with Sayyid Hussein's ways.
He then dispatched youth to Sana'a to spread his ideology. These emissaries were met by the brutality of security forces and thrown into security, political prisons, or other kinds of prisons.
The government commanded them to stay in the mountains and even offered to pay them to do this. But Sayyid Abdul Malik rejected these demands, and hence a third war began, which was the beginning of victories.
It could be interpreted from the measures the government implemented during this third war that it sought to utterly annihilate the movement.
Meetings took place between Saudi Arabia and the US over how to steer the war towards achieving the total eradication of the Houthi movement once and for all. Houthis were bombarded with false accusations and subjected to a massive propaganda campaign.
And when the third war started, most all of the fighters followed the lead of Sayyid Abdul Malik.
The third war took place in March 2006 under the command of Ali Mohsen Al-Ahmar. But this time it was the Houthis that won, delivering a heavy toll upon the aggressors. The victory further affirmed the position of Abdul Malik and the Houthis as heroes among the people, while causing deeper concern for the Yemeni government and consequently the Saudis. Saleh put on a public face, but in secret he was planning vengeance.
Then they released all the prisoners as part of their plan to prepare themselves for a fourth war, which was indeed a war of eradication. Since it was not tactful to kill 800 inmates whilst incarcerated, they released them so they could be killed on the battlefield. Then commencement of the fourth war was violated. Just imagine a sudden onslaught of aggression directed at a single location, with all the weaponry in their position, with around-the-clock attacks. But by the grace of God the Almighty, the defenders withstood this aggression and claimed victory. Warfare ended, leaving the government in defeat and weakened.
بعدها توقفت الحرب ووضعت الحرب أوزارها عجز وهزيمة.
The victors were Ansarullah. The win enabled the group to capitalize on their position and on their wartime experience to negotiate an agreement with the government. But there was a fifth war, and it was during this that the Ansarullah movement increased their claim, managing to free Al-Maran and forcing the government to withdraw from the area as well as many other areas in Sa'ada.
The fifth war began in March 2008 and ended in January the following year with a resounding victory for the Houthis. Their momentum led to a significant growth in awareness of the people, who were all invited to become acquainted with the Al-Shabaab al-Mu'min's movement, thereafter identified as Ansarullah.
The movement grew and spread beyond Sa'ada governorate into Hajar, Al-Jawf, and Amran, capturing greater influence in other governorates, expanding remarkably quickly.
And the fighters' faith in Sayyid Abdul Malik's ability to direct the group grew at every stage.
Each time the aggressors started their ways, the Yemeni youth became more resistant, more determined. This was very noticeable following the third war, the fourth and fifth wars. We cannot predict such a phenomenon would occur.
Then there came a sixth war between the government and Ansarullah, with Saudi Arabia and the US ready to prop up the government to join in. Eventually, 28 countries became involved in this war.
Saudi Arabia had supported the Yemeni government in all of its previous wars on Ansarullah. In the sixth one, the Wahhabi kingdom used their own fighters in direct confrontations.
And they sought to enter Sa'ada governorate with military forces in an attempt to destroy outright the Al-Shabaab al-Mu'min movement.
Saudi Arabia entered the war directly, decimating suburbs, dropping bombs from their planes from their American aircrafts.
More than 20,000 houses were destroyed and thousands of people were killed, particularly among the civilians, women, children, and the elderly. In fact, they intentionally destroyed homes while the people were still inside. And in some cases, these civilians lived outside the confrontation zone in peaceful residential areas which did not have relevance to the battleground.
The Yemenis had to understand how dearly it would cost them to adhere to Ansar Allah's ideology. Many people were massacred by the bombardment of Saudi and American warplanes, and many infrastructures and property were destroyed. Compared to the previous wars, the Sixth War was the most vicious and most complicated one for Ansar Allah.
The Sixth War was basically a massacre, which the Yemeni government was carrying out assisted by Saudi Arabia, and even American aircraft had come to the fray. They carried out indiscriminate killings of civilians, and their aim was to inflict the most possible amount of loss and damage. However, the loss suffered by the aggressors, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and other countries which confronted the Ansar Allah movement, was so apparent that it made our victories greater.
Al-Shabaab al-Mu'min adopted a new form of self-defense in their fighting, which led to the defeat of the Saudi army, laying bare its weaknesses and disgracing it amongst the other armies of the world. Despite Saudi Arabia possessing highly sophisticated weaponry and equipment, bought mainly from the United States, the kingdom did not manage to conquer anything on the ground. Instead, Al-Shabaab al-Mu'min, otherwise known as the Houthis, managed to advance into Saudi soil, especially in Al-Dukhan and the Al-Jaberi Mountains, where they stayed and left only after signing an agreement with the Yemeni central government. This was an important juncture in the progress made by the Al-Shabaab al-Mu'min.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
It was the last known missile fired by the United States in its 20-year war in Afghanistan, and the U.S. military called it a righteous strike, a drone attack after hours of surveillance on 29th of August against a vehicle that American officials thought contained an ISIS bomb and posed an imminent threat to U.S. troops at Kabul Airport. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Matthew Akins, Christopher Cottle, Evan Hill, and Eric Schmidt. The piece is titled, New York Times Investigation in U.S. Drone Strike Evidence Suggests No ISIS Bomb. Stay with us for more. It was the last known missile fired by the United States in its 20-year war in Afghanistan, and the U.S. military called it a righteous strike, a drone attack after hours of surveillance on 29th of August against a vehicle that American officials thought contained an ISIS bomb and posed an imminent threat to U.S. troops at Kabul Airport. But a New York Times investigation of video evidence, along with interviews with more than a dozen of the driver's co-workers and family members in Kabul, raises serious doubts about the U.S. version of the events, including whether explosives were present in the vehicle, whether the driver had a connection to ISIS, and whether there was a second explosion after the missile struck the car. Military officials said they did not know the identity of the car's driver when the drone fired, but deemed him suspicious because of how they interpreted his activities on that day, saying that he possibly visited an ISIF safe house and, at one point, loaded what they thought could be explosives into his car. The New York Times reporting has identified the driver as Zamari Ahmadi, a long-time worker for a U.S. aid group. The evidence suggests that his travels that day actually involved transporting colleagues to and from work, and an analysis of video feed